Good evening.
Good evening.
As my Sangha knows, I am one of those wind-up toys where you wind me up and I start talking and I cannot stop sometimes, so I'm going to put this watch here and hopefully that will limit my time. And remind me again, what time do you usually stop?
Quarter to nine.
So my name is Ami Diller, Sensei Chikko Genryu, and as Doralee mentioned, I am teaching in both the Tibetan and the Zen tradition, for those of you who don't know. And my home base in Zen is the Everyday Zen Sangha in the Bay Area, and this is my Sacramento home. And about a year ago, coming up on a year ago, I returned from a three-month practice period at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, which was a very sweet time because it was a full circle. That's where I began my Zen practice oh so many years ago. And recently what I've noticed is that this question is arising. I don't know if you've experienced this phenomena of questions, like the Genjo koans of our lives that return over and over again and arise. And we circle back to them, and each time they touch something at a different level and a little more deeply and with new, sometimes it becomes a doorway to new meaning. I love monastic practice. I really do. You make one decision, you jump into the kettle and you boil. True, it's we kind of joke about it being a pressure cooker, because what you do is you really surrender to the forms, to the schedule, and it's a beautiful beautiful coming together of everyone having one purpose. A friend of mine walked the Camino. How many of you have done that? Has anyone in this room done it? The Camino de Santiago. And she was telling me that as she got towards Santiago, what she loved was it was like she began to feel like one of this herd of caribou all migrating towards one place. And there was such this wonderful communal feel. And that would come up for me several times at Tassajara. The bell would ring and there would be this wonderful communal movement towards the Zendo, towards the bathhouse, towards whatever came next. And this way that in the sacredness, the community, the connection, the belonging of that container, we found, or I found, I should say, a sweet heart-opening doorway to each other and to the inner life, and to that part of that interrelatedness that's so ineffable and meaningful. So my question recently that's been bubbling up rather surprisingly is, what does it mean to bring Zen home? Like, what does it mean really truly to practice in the midst of our daily lives? That's what we talk about Zen and all the time, right? There is no moment of not practicing when we're thoroughly practicing. And it occurred to me that I have this book that I had not gotten around to reading, a long-neglected Zen book. I don't know if any of you are like me, where you have a bookshelf or many bookshelves full of books you intend to read someday. Every time we think about moving, my husband jokes, this time we're leaving your books behind. So I returned to this one that was published way back in 2011 called Bringing Zen Home, The Healing Heart of Japanese Women's Rituals by Paula Aray. Have any of you heard of that? Do you know it? So it's a quality, she's a researcher, she's a scholar, and she's also a very fluent Japanese speaker, so she did a qualitative study. And for those of you who don't know, the difference between a quantitative study and a qualitative study is a qualitative study is you really ask the people, deep questions about whatever it is you're investigating. So she had 12 women, and she spent time with them. She became intimate with them. She got to know them, and she asked them questions about their lives in regards to their practice in their homes. I was so excited by this book that I took 24 pages of notes for this talk tonight. And this afternoon I went through the winnowing process. And so far I haven't looked at a single note, so we'll see how it goes. But I was really wondering, like, why does it touch me so deeply, and why do I feel like it's important? And first of all, it resonated with me that our idea of what Zen is or can become incredibly narrow. Mostly, I think, or I would guess, that when we think of Zen, we often think of what young Japanese men in the 19th century did in Zen temples, right? So I would say that's what young Japanese men of the late 19th century did in Zen monasteries. That isn't necessarily Zen. It's still a wonderful and important thing. But we still don't have a full and complete historical picture of Zen and the development of Zen. And this always saddens me, because when we don't have that full, rich tapestry of historical, diverse Zen material of how people actually practice in the midst of their lives, we've lost something. And this image of the 19th century samurai monk becomes the dominant image of Zen, to the point where I had this hilarious experience in Bodh Gaya many, many years ago, when I was practicing, and we were holding a Rohatsu Sesshin in Bodh Gaya. And we would go every day, and we would sit outside under the Bodhi tree, and we would circumambulate the stupa. And on one corner, there was a lot of Tibetans that were holding a prayer ritual there. So we're, you know, very seriously looking at the ground and circumambulating, doing kinhin, and not looking at anybody when we go from our makeshift zendo to the Bodhi tree and back. And meanwhile, these Tibetans are creating a great din, like lots of noise and kids running around. And it's just this total, looks like me to me, like chaos. So at one point, my friend and I are in the end of the kinhin line. And these two little Tibetan boys blow up this paper bag like a balloon, and they come up behind us and they go, we were like, ah! And they're laughing and laughing. And the Tibetan monks standing around are laughing hilariously. And so when he and I, my friend and I, went to get supplies for the Zendo later on, the monks are looking at us and go, oh, we know you. Zen. No. So that's a pervasive image, and I still get that response. I don't know if any of you do, but I still do. And so I wonder, how embedded is this in our psyche, right? And how embedded is it in some subtle way that we use it as a ruler to measure our own practice against? Because I've been thinking, too, about how our very deep conscious, subtle conscious, unconscious level of our expectations about our practice begin to merge with our own westernized, judgmental, often self-criticizing, dare I say, minds, and have us coming up short. So this incomplete historical picture of the rich, I keep calling it this rich tapestry of how Zen people actually practice in historical Zen. We're talking about, what, 2,000 years? Chan Zen? Yeah, this is a long time of a lot of people practicing Zen. And I entered Tassajara at age 20, 1980. And as you may know, it was one of the first American monasteries of Zen practice, and it was one of the first American or Zen practice monasteries anywhere that was inviting men and women to practice together. Richard Baker once very famously said, you know what you get when you have women and men monks practicing together? Babies. You got it. And that was, in fact, often the case. But we also had this wonderful beginning of a conversation. And there is a point in one of the question and answer. I was a burgeoning feminist. That's what was happening then. We were beginning to question everything, or continuing to question everything. And this was still very much modeled on the 19th century Japanese monastic model, quite intentionally. We were beginning to still ask these questions, and these were arising. What is the place of women priests in Zen? Can Zen women become roshis? And if they can, will any men come to study with them? I mean, these were really the questions we were asking that were being asked at the time. And it's kind of, I don't know, a little bit amazing that this is how far we've come in a lifetime. So I began to ask, if these are the questions, what's the place for women in Zen? Meaning, because it's very personal, there's that, especially at that age, you know, what is my place? Is there a place for me? And does gender matter? So I asked the abbot in a public question and answer at one point, and I have no memory if Karen and Jim were there. We overlapped, so you may have been there when I asked this question. I asked, why was it necessary for the Dragon King's daughter to change into the form of a man before becoming enlightened? And the abbot's response was to look at me with what I interpreted as a little bit of pity, saying, is that really your question? As if dear was implied. Is that really your question, dear? And I felt that whoosh in my gut, right? That was intense, you know? And I didn't know how to answer because it was my question. Well, it really, truly was. And yes, non-dual reality is true. It is a reality. There is a place, there is a perspective from which there is no difference between genders, right? There is no difference. And yet, there is this form, realm of conventional reality where our particularity matters. It informs our lived day-to-day experience. So, we began, some of myself and some other women, all young practitioners at the time, decided that we would try and hold a women's group to begin to explore what is it to practice in these women's bodies. And we encountered quite a bit of resistance and some ridicule. But we were really realizing that at that point, we were prostrating to a lineage of men every day, over and over and over again. So we began to say and think and realize and explore the fact that all these male teachers couldn't answer our questions like, do you find that your meditation changes in relationship to your moon cycle? I mean, male teachers had a bit of a question, I mean, issues with those questions. Or, what is it like to practice as a pregnant woman as a mother? And how do you sit zazen with intense cramps? So I wasn't finding any guidance anywhere, right? in this at the time. And this was one of these ways where instead of thinking, in some ways, even though taking these steps to engage women, to engage our practice, there is this little sense of, oh, but we're not quite fitting in to Zen. Are we really being Zen? And somewhere I believed inside of me that there was an invisible lineage of women who had practiced and lived and awakened in these bodies and in these circumstances, in their particularities. So I feel that this is important because I'm speaking from a very gender, race, socioeconomic, culturally specific view, right? And how do we bring Zen home to who we are in our circumstances? Where are our role models? We're creating them, right? But what made me so excited about this book is to find that invisible lineage that I intuitively believed was there. So now there's a lot more written on women's practice than when I was young, right? Zen Center has the lineage of women's ancestors. And there are wonderful books about women's koans and women's practice. But mainly a lot of women's scholarly work is what's delving into women's practice in terms of day-to-day. So I wonder, is there still room to explore? And why not continue to include broader and more inclusive ways of talking about practice, how we live as practitioners in the world, about our diverse paths to come to the experience of awakening, to our Buddha nature? Why not have more images and metaphors and stories? So this book for me was a wonderful contribution to that, to broadening our understanding of diverse and authentic Zen practice historically. Another reason the material was important to me is that most of us, like I said, are not monastic. So most of us, if not all of us in this room, are living as householders. And as we know, life as householders is dramatically different than as celibate monks. So reading this book, it really hit me in the last, again, you know, couple thousand years in Japan, we haven't heard what was the experience of domestic practitioners. And these women, because they were excluded from the monastic life, they were basically default householders. Paula Aray said, Zen in the daily life of a family is creative and flexible, unlike its monastic counterpoint, which thrives on control, discipline, and impeccable cleanliness. Domestic Zen, I love that, domestic Zen, is at home with the chaotic, emotional, and messy lives of people struggling with their families, health, and jobs, right? So because these women were refused entrance into the monastic communities, they can be, you know, they had to figure it out creatively within that messy, domestic, emotional, relational context and matrix. So wouldn't it be helpful for us to know what they did, to know how they did this? Maybe it could point a direction for us. So in this book, the practice of what Paula Aray calls domestic Zen focused on the women of generation where they're tending to children, where they're tending to adults that are in their family and ill, where they're tending to, parents, just like us, the full array. And they took care of their families. They took care of their family altars. It's the heart of every Zen home in Japan at that time, I don't know about today, to have an altar to your family and an altar to your ancestors, right? And so the women of that generation in that time would be doing practices, doing things around both of their altars every day. And the way they would do that is through ritual, and the context was through healing. And so she said, studying the ritual lives of Japanese women reveals a domestic aspect of Zen that's ripe with wisdom for responding to a host of everyday challenges, difficulties, and fears. So this is the point where one of the idea of ritual and healing was so intertwined that one of the women in this qualitative study said domestic Zen defined Zen, actually her Zen practice, as quote unquote healing in the midst of a mess. And I love that. Healing in the midst of a mess. So especially powerful for these women, finding their way, healing in the midst of a mess, were the teachings of Dogen. And specifically, Dogen's teaching and Shakyamuni's Buddha's teaching that we all are Buddha nature from the very beginning, that we can realize, practice enlightenment. There, a moment of true practice is a moment of true enlightenment. And thus, right in the midst of our messy, emotional, chaotic lives, we can tap into that and fundamentally heal from the delusions that trigger despair and loneliness and suffering. Because the woman asks, so, okay, you know, we're healing. What are we healing from? We're healing from the problem of delusion. Because they see suffering as a delusion that we're separate, self-standing, alone, and not related to the fabric of reality, the world around us. In English, the word to heal means to make whole. So health is wholeness. And these women really saw health as not, are you healthy? Are you sick? You know, what's your diagnosis? It was recognized as a quality of relationship with the living, the deceased, with the psychosocial aspects, emotional aspects of the world, and how they needed to be in balance, how each one of those needed to be healthy. And so it's a model of interrelatedness, and it's an assumption of totality. So I was thinking about this, an assumption of totality. It's an assumption of belonging, right? Which I think is really hard for us to even tap into in the modern world. So I'm taking, and some of my Sangha members right now are taking a course of Stanford's Cultivating Compassion Training. And the woman who's teaching it is from Korea. And she was talking to us recently about self-compassion and developing self-compassion. And she said, you know, I hear from you, Westerners, because she's been here for quite a while and coming and going. And I've heard this thing about self-criticism and self-judgment and self-loathing. And she said, I have to tell you, I don't feel that. I don't experience that. And I've heard this before about people from the East, about Tibetans, about Japanese, about Koreans. We heard a great story about His Holiness the Dalai Lama hearing that same thing and going, what, you know, explain this to me. But I've never actually had the opportunity to talk to someone who fundamentally didn't feel any sense, like she didn't literally feel any sense of a self-criticism voice. And she said, someone said, well, what happens when you make a mistake? And she said, well, when I make a mistake, I learn from it and I go on. Like I say, oh, yeah, I may have been able to do that better. And that's it. So at the break, I said, come on, tell me, do you really, come on, do you really not know what it means to have a sense of like this self lack of worth? And she said, no, I do now because I've really intellectually grappled with it. I've tried to understand it so I can teach this here in the United States. She said, so I have an intellectual understanding, but I really don't understand. And so I was thinking about this in the context of interrelatedness. Could you imagine what it's like to grow up in a culture where your assumption is that the world is totally, utterly interrelated? Right? That you had the assumption that Indra's net isn't a philosophical Buddhist teaching, but it's really true that what you do in the privacy of your own home, in front of your own home altar, or communally with your small group of women, reverberates through the whole universe and matters. Right? That it matters, that you in this world matter. And not only that, that you are integral to this web of Indra's net. That this universe is such that if you weren't you, and you weren't in this world wouldn't be this world. That was the air that you breathed, that was the water you swam in, right? To the point that one of the women was, when Paula began her qualitative study, she asked the women, have you ever received a healing? Have you ever been healed? And they did not understand the question. And she rephrased it in a Japanese manner that she calls the gratitude conjugation, which goes something like, have you ever been the humble and grateful recipient of the interrelated causes and conditions for healing? Wow. Right? I mean, we don't even have language for that. We just like, you know, oh, you know, I hear you have a cold. Are you feeling better? But have you been the recipient, the humble and grateful recipient of the interrelated causes and conditions for healing? You know, that's practice. You know, that's the ground, the culture, the assumption that Dogen was teaching from, that the Buddha was teaching from, that was woven into the fabric of not only the monastic lives, but of Zen practice, of bringing Zen home. So, I'm flipping to the last page because I looked at the time. There's so much. Like I said, this is, 24 plus pages of notes boiled down. So just to have a snapshot that these are women doing domestic Zen healing in the midst of a mess. And one of the things they don't do is meditate. And they consider themselves committed, lifelong Zen practitioners, followers of Dogen. Right? Interesting. So what do? They do the family altar, they chant, they copy sutras, they go about cleaning their cleaning tasks, thinking that everything that they're doing to clean is cleaning their heart mind. They said it, every time I'm cleaning the house, I'm cleaning my heart mind. They're doctoring their families. They write out sacred symbols on paper in esoteric tradition, and they actually then eat the paper that the symbols have been calligraphed on as medicine. And they gather water from sacred sources, and then they bring that water and they include it in the tea that they make for their family and for guests, right? And it's all with the sense that the type of practices found in domestic Zen are done in amidst the sound of water running for the laundry, dishes and baths. They're done with the aroma of food, cooking and incense burning. Adding mitsutori, that sacred water that I mentioned, to the rice that the family will eat for dinner is seen as much as a key ingredient in nurturing the family as adding soy sauce and seasonings. It is because these practices are woven into the demands of daily family life that they are practical, effective, and deep. So there is so much richness in this book that she talks about, and I invite you to explore it. And the question that I had was, how might this relate to you, right? Have you stopped to consider yourselves the difference between routine and ritual? Have you considered for yourselves in your life what is the difference between routine and ritual? Right? Because they're talking about ritual as being healing, whole, connecting with something greater. What Tara Brach calls the sacred pause. What is it that connects us with the sacred in the midst of our moment-to-moment life? So what is the difference for you between a routine and a ritual? Are there ways in your life that you have and do already engage in ritual that you might not notice? You know, moments that you ground, that you create with the sacred. So I think personally of a routine as that becomes an ingrained subconscious habit that I don't even notice I'm doing. For instance, very mundane, driving down the middle of the road without crossing the lines, that's a habit, right? What is it then? Is there a way to turn these things that we don't attend to into a sacred moment? And I assume that as practitioners, this is something you're all in some way doing to reconnect. We have 3 minutes. We can either do questions or we could do pairs. Yes? I have a question. Question, answer, moment of discussion. Is this on?
Thank you for sharing such a warm and tender moment in the practice of Zen when speaking about the mothers who were always there from the beginning, going all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha and Ehei Dogen. So it's not that invisible to me that the first teacher of any Roshi was the mother. Bringing Zen home, I would like to say self or non-self or form and formlessness, but that's not for me what brings Zen home. And I could say that I sleep, eat, and breathe Zen and the practice, and that might be another way of saying it, but that's not it. When I'm out and about, and I'm not sitting or I'm not in my room, and I'm out and about, and I see the suffering around me, and I take it in, not as something other than or outside of me, but something that's inside of me, that is very much a part of me. And I'm able, in some way, in some small way, bring some form of healing, and not necessarily with words, but with the actual contact of shared moments. That to me, and in many ways, for me, it's radical, but it is the only way that I know it to be true to bring healing, not only for myself, because I do get healing from that. But it's the only way that I know that is bringing it home, and how the truth in the practice becomes real and palpable and dynamic.
Thank you.
Ami, I think it would be wonderful if you could rewrite the Fuka Zazengi.
How so?
As a woman practicing every day without ritual, because in a way that's a very alienating poem in that regard. Doesn't tell me anything about everyday life. Mm-hmm. Doesn't tell me anything about how to be in the world without part of or separate from, or I don't get any of that from that. So yeah, that really, what you were saying about the sweeping, you know, I sweep every day, but I open the doors and the dust comes in, and so I sweep again the next day. So why do I sweep? That's part of my practice. Mm-hmm. It's useless, it's fruitless, but I do it. I think that poem needs to be rewritten.
Maybe you can write the first draft.
No, I don't know.
Thank you.
What was the, sorry if you said this and I missed it, but what was the era where these women lived?
This was, she completed her research a couple years before she finished the book, so most of them were born right post-World War II, if I remember correctly. And so the research was fairly modern.
Were they living, were they non-monastics?
They're all non-monastic women, all householders. There's another wonderful book called Zen Ritual, and she and another woman have articles in that. And they talk about a particular woman, Roshi, in Japan, who was her introduction to these particular women. And that's where they all practice Zen.
And lastly, I can't remember her first name, but there's a lady, her last name is Greenwood, and she recently wrote a book. Just Enough?
Yeah, what is it?
No, that's her cookbook. She wrote one before that.
Oh, well, the one she just wrote.
Yeah, well, anyway, she... Claire Greenwood, yeah. She wrote a book about her experience as a female monastic in Japan. It's really interesting. I'd recommend it.
Thank you.
Another viewpoint.
Haven't read it. Okay.
I want to thank you for sharing your adventure and challenge of being a woman in the 80s and standing up in your own way for the struggle of women in the 70s and 80s and bringing attention to the ordinary. And thank you for doing that for
thank
all of us.
Yes. Thank you. My pleasure, and we weren't alone.